I just want to take this opportunity to encourage anyone with an interest in programming for all CUL staff to consider running for the Library Forum Steering Committee. There will be 4 vacancies this time around, and I know for a fact that the 2 remaining members, Jessica Withers and Randy Kevitz, would really love it if people ran. Everybody is encouraged and eligible to run. We're going to be putting out a call for volunteers and nominations in April, and the elections will take place in May. And also the totally happening Career Development Committee and possibly the Mentorship Committee, I'm not sure, they might not want to let go of any places yet, will also have openings this summer. And please consider participating in one of these 3 committees and taking the opportunity to help create a climate of well-being at the library, to weigh in on important issues and become more engaged in the life of the library. So on February 6, 1961, Olin Library opened its doors at the actually really peculiar hour of 7:50 in the morning. I'm not really sure about that. And to mark Olin's birthday, there will be an exhibition highlighting all kinds of cool and interesting library-related things. There will be a birthday party. There's a birthday party right now, here, right now. And there are going to be some great reunion events. And we're really happy, the Library Forum is really happy, that Anne and Dean have agreed to kick us off with their Library Salon presentation, then and now, which is a lighthearted review of the past 50 years and a look at where the library is going. So please join me in welcoming Ann Kenny, Carl A. Cross University Librarian, and Dean Kraft, the Library's Chief Technology Strategist and Director of IT.
Hi, everybody. Dean's got a bigger title than I do, so I'm going to have to work on a new title. So you may have noticed I have a really cool jacket on. It's wool, it's a little itchy. It is Claire Wiedemeyer's jacket from the class of 1960. I know it's Claire's because she has her name in the back of this, and it says 60 right here. And I gather that in the junior year, students would get their blazers. And the men's blazers were blue for some darn reason. And it was always a big deal to figure out the kind of logo that would come. I mean, it was always had to be a C in there, but how it would look on the pocket. So, and of course, I have these are, by the way, from the Division of Rare and Manuscripts collection, which they kindly lent me, and I had to, you know, sign away my child's life if I lost them. And this, of course, is JFK's running for president button, coming from the Political Americana collection. Now, I understand, Little Bird told me that Ada, are you here? Was actually here for the opening. No?
I was here.
But you were on campus when Olin opened. So we are going to direct all the questions after our presentation. We did this presentation last week in Washington, D.C. for, 800 Cornellians descended on hotel in Washington, D.C. They all wore red turtlenecks and gray slacks. It was kind of interesting. So, to set the context for the opening of Cornell's Olin Library,
it's in the front of it.
There we go. Tell you a little bit about 50 years ago, first in the nation and then at Cornell, 1961, began with JFK's becoming the 35th President of the United States. His inaugural speech, of course, is what is most memorable about that occasion, the Ask Not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. However, it was held in a blizzard in D.C. There were 10,000 cars stalled around the nation's capital. Most of them were abandoned. J. Edgar Hoover could not make it. He was stuck in Florida. But all of that was forgotten when Kennedy stood up to speak. Ironically, 1961 is also the birth year of our current president. And on campus, it was enriched by the presence of some really prominent faculty, including Hans Bethe, whom you see here, Walter Feit, Walter Lefevre, George Kahan, Alfred Kahn, Clinton Rossiter, and the first woman to serve in a president's cabinet, Frances Perkins. The class of 1964 was 30% women and 70% men, and included Pete Gogolak, who went on to play for the Buffalo Bills and the Giants, singer Harry Chapin. Also on campus was Keith Downey, who invented canola oil. I love that. Robert Moog, the Moog synthesizer. Myra Hart, co-founder of Staples. Motivational gurus Tom Peters and Ken Blanchard. Richard Farina, been down so long, looks like up to me. Tatan Tata, whose actually automobile is on exhibit at Sibley. And Michael Schwerner, class of 61, who was murdered in Mississippi during the voter registration drive there in 1964. And this is the quiz. What hit was in the top 10 when the class of 1964 were freshmen? Was it Twist and Shout by the Beatles?
No.
Stop going. Do I hear the other choice? Stuck on You by Elvis Presley, or Dancing in the Street with Martha and the Vandellas?
Two.
Did you go with Martha? Yeah. He is so smooth. Yes, it was Elvis the Pelvis. He had been three times on the Ed Sullivan Show, including at least one time where they showed his full torso. Incoming freshmen received a copy of the Cornell Desk Book, and we have them down here, and they're lots of fun reading, which provided the essentials of what to bring to campus and what to expect your freshman year. They were particularly prescriptive about what to wear. So, for the men, quote, neatness is the first clue to good appearance in the classroom, on a date, or merely out for a stroll about campus. Sports jackets and ties are preferred. Sweaters are okay, but not your high school letter sweater. All men, except for vets, vets of military service, not folks in the vet school, had to pass a swimming test. The women did not have to pass a swimming test. Does anybody know why? Ada. Yeah, and we couldn't use their pool. And the men took their swimming test in the nude. Those in agriculture had to take farm practice tests. I don't know what a farm practice test is, but it sounded pretty cool to me. Yeah, they were. Women, too, received guidance. Sweaters, blouses, wool skirts, bobby socks, knee socks for cold weather. Slacks really only preferred on cold days. And for dates, heels or flats, depending upon the height of your date. Freshman women had curfews, yeah. 10:30 on weeknights, and then there were 2 days a week. Most people chose Friday and Saturday night. And there's a little bit of discrepancy on whether it was midnight or 1. The desk book said that it was midnight, or maybe it was 1, and somebody at this thing we were at said, no, 2:30, you can have one night for 2:30. There was a survey in 1960 about sexual attitudes and behaviors. The entire sample of women reported that they were virgins. As I mentioned, they didn't have to take a swimming test, but elementary dancing was a mandatory PE requirement for the women, not for the men. What they said. Besides clothing, portable technology was all the rage, such as portable record player, typewriter. The electric typewriter was introduced in 1957, but the real rage in 1960 on was the power carriage return. TVs had become portable. They only weighed 26 pounds. And, of course, the slide rule continued to rule through the 1960s. The 1975 was the last manufacturer of slide rules stopped making them. The Cornell desk book also clued you in to basic campus jargon. We know what the hill is. I was talking with one person who was saying, oh, West Campus, that looks pretty good. You know, and it's really close to campus, close to the Arts Quad. But they didn't give him the topo map, so he didn't know that it was uphill to get there. The Quad, of course, is the Arts Quad. The Ivy Room, where people went for their study dates, breaks from studying, 15 cents a cup of coffee. Louis Lunch, still there. Used to be parked out outside of the women's dorms, and the average weight gain for freshman women was 10 pounds. And, of course, the Live. And when they entered in the fall of 1960, the Live was the university library, which is now U.S. Library. In the book, it was described as, quote, a very impressive library, complete with tower, clock, and chimes. Those who know it say it has a good collection of books and a good place to spend time studying. But in the middle of the freshman year, as Carlos said, February 6th, so this Sunday at 7:50 in the morning, I think you all ought to have a moment of silence. An event marked the end and the beginning. The closing of the university library after 70 years of service, it would reopen 2 years later as the undergraduate library. And the beginning, of course, was the opening of the first purpose-built library in the country built as a research facility. It was considered the single greatest accomplishment of then-President Malott's tenure. And he said, quote, we have built many other buildings on this campus, and we will build many more. But none is or will be so important to the university's capabilities or so descriptive of its character as this one. Cost $5.7 million to build, and the funds came from trustee John M. Olin. 240,000 square feet. Now, Olin was generally pretty well received, but it was not without its critics, including those who were mourning the passing of Boardman Hall. The former dean of architecture called it a vulgar modernization, and others likened it to an IBM punch card, sort of prefiguring the future, especially at night. By the way, in 1960, sale of blank punch cards alone represented 30% of IBM's revenues. The old don't fold, spindle, and mutilate. Ironically, each of those punch holes represented a window into a world of people and books. And the top six floors were closed stacks for undergraduates. So one entered through Tiger Alley, which I have heard recently called Barcode Alley. And since it was closed to undergrads, they would go to the circ desk. And you all know the lights there. The stacks were not opened until January of 1993. I think many of us were here for that. It took 9,800 person hours to maintain the system of closed stacks. Mm-hmm. Books were retrieved by pneumatic tubes, and when it arrived, your number would flash. This newfangled approach irritated some, and the Sun editorial in 1962 wrote, "This awe-inspiring structure strikes more than awe in the hearts of those who wish to request a book at the circ desk. Conceivably, the first impression of the novice is that this is the center of some enormous numbers racket. That the flashing numbers signify the winner of a derby or bingo." Of course, to find a book, one had to consult the card catalog, which held over 10 million individual index cards. It was not retired until 2007. It took 30 years to convert it online. And in fact, the disaster plan for Olin called for saving that catalog first. It was the union catalog for all of the library system. Forget the books. All that work that went into the card catalog. Olin was built for books, but also as a place for research and independent study. This was until, 10 years ago maybe, Lee? The periodical room, and now it's the cafe, where one could go to consult newspapers in paper and on microfilm, as well as the latest journals in humanities and social sciences. And Olin, first floor, was also a place for individual study. On the heaviest days of use during an academic semester, 35% to 40% of the university community would enter Olin Library. Of course, there was no food or drink allowed, but smoking was. It is pretty ironic that we are just now installing sprinklers. The library remained open until 11:30 at night, when the clock tower bells would play the Peer Gynt Suite. And when exiting, one had to show books and possessions. This guard there was replaced by security gate in the early 90s, when most of the collection had been security stripped. By their senior year, increasing interest in computers in the library and in the university was all the rage. The computer science department was founded. IBM introduced the first mass-produced computer operating system, and the library demonstrated the UNIVAC computer for producing reference articles on 75 subjects in four languages at the 1964 World's Fair. And this is librarian Gary Mengus. I don't know if anybody remembers Gary. The Sun, gotta bless the Sun, editorial began to speculate on the future of libraries. Can computers replace bookshelves? Can IBM data processing condense all the vast information of a library into a teacup? Yes, they concluded. The possibility of automatic libraries is slowly evolving into a probability. And, of course, rumors of the demise of libraries remain today. Here, I think you've seen this before, the extinction timeline, which predicts by about 2018 libraries will be a thing of the past, as will unfenced beaches, post offices, and Size Zero. I'm really happy to see the Size Zero go. Then university librarian McCartney wrote in 1961, in response to these speculations, "At various times in the past 25 years, I've been informed that library problems would be solved by extensive microfilming or storing information on tapes and drums and retrieved through the use of computers. Despite the mechanical and electronic equipment, which will undoubtedly come, there will be a continuing need for collections of books and for intelligent, imaginative, and efficient librarians. So, as we consider the changes this century will wrought, I'm betting that the research library will continue to support both. They will be places for deep research and contemplative thought, as well as becoming much more both as virtual spaces and as content and services delivered out to our users. So to tell us all about this brave new world, Dean.
Let's start with a quote from a nice baseball guy, Yogi Berra: "The future ain't what it used to be." If you think about it a minute, the future is not only different than the past, but almost always the future is different than we envision it will be when we're in the past. So Anne has talked about the sort of physical place and the essential nature of the library as a place to go and to access materials. Here's a nice quote from Larkin Dempsey in 2006, a little while ago now: "We cannot expect the user to come to the library anymore. In fact, we cannot expect the user even to come to the library website anymore." The good news is that students are still coming to the library, and occasionally to the Hogwarts library. And, you know, it provides them a place to connect with physical resources, to put their game face on, to really connect with their studying, and also places to collaborate, get a good cup of coffee, or perhaps even take a little nap. But for today's users, the library catalog is nowhere near the center of their information universe. So it's a challenge for us. We really need to make sure that we put the library where our users are going and get Cornell out there. So in 2011, in the age of Google, what is the library's unique value? We used to provide this vertically integrated bundle of services that were focused on a physical location and physical materials. The web, the internet really breaks that apart in digitization. And we have a challenge. We have to identify and provide critical strategic library services and unbundle the rest, make the changes before it gets the world does it to us. Good news is we do hold a lot of unique special collections, items where we're the sole source and provider. And in fact, in some cases, we hold unique special collections that didn't even exist in 1961.
Any time with undergraduates, you've worked with textbooks, you work with secondary materials, but these materials are primary source materials. They get their hands on them. They have control over the content and focus of the class. They're involved in the design, and it's much more an approach that I use when I'm teaching graduate students. The idea of a class based on research is so open-ended, but in such a great way. And, I mean, being in an academic setting is two things. One, it's often very structured, and I think for me it's been really interesting to have a class that maybe isn't as much structured. We're working with the library, we're working with, you know, real people and the objects.
It's really nice that I'm given the opportunity to explore so many different musical avenues, and that's what Cornell really does do. You know, they bring out, like, classes that you wouldn't think a university would think would be applicable to, you know, academia, which is really nice. And I think that's what Cornell is all about. You know, they say any person, any study, and, you know, they hit it right on the nail.
One of the things that is different in this class from most any of the classes I've taught or even experienced is that the students are the ones in control of the materials. They're the ones who are developing the research questions. They're the ones that are manipulating the materials and coming up with the answers that that are driven by their experience with the material.
So even our special collections and the way we access them are evolving. So we're not just at the mercy of digital technologies. Fortunately, the outside world is not simply acting upon us. We have an opportunity to use technology to create new opportunities, new resources, new value for research library users. We had a number of great image collections that were somewhat hidden in silos, as you may be familiar with Luna. It could be a little hard for people certainly outside of Cornell and also within Cornell to get access to them. Group called the Library Outside the Library. We've got Diane Dietrich right here, who played the major role in this effort, has worked to put these images up on social media site Flickr, starting with the 80 White Architectural Photos collection, but then adding a bunch of others, Korean images, Willard Strait, Human Ecology. In addition to making the resources more visible, social media sites allow others to come and add context and value to them. In this case, tagging in Swedish, which is nice. We've gotten a pretty good response, certainly compared to how they were being seen in Luna. At this point, we're over 500,000 all-time views of the Flickr collection. So that's pretty good. And people have said nice things about it. Flickr, it must rock to be a librarian in this age. Certainly no argument here, I'm sure. We can also respond quickly. A year ago, there was the eruption and volcanic eruption in Iceland. We got up the Icelandic collection, including an image of the volcano, whose name I am not going to try and pronounce, from 1900 shot. So beyond just accessibility and making stuff more visible, digital opens up totally new possibilities. Okay. It's a system called Photoshin. It's sort of a model for lots of different views into and perspectives on information. So it's a real synthesis of independent observations. This is the Piazza San Marco in Venice. And essentially this is a collection of individual photographs, you know, off of Flickr, different cameras, different people, different whatever, and the computer system lets you synthesize these into an integrated three-dimensional model, and then to zoom in on any sort of individual observation, and you'll see that, you know, they're all different people, so it's identifying the sort of similar features and putting it all together, so matching up the pieces, and then having a system that lets you really explore and visualize the full space of information. Very exciting. Interestingly enough, researchers at Cornell and the University of Washington's computer science departments created a photo game for students that essentially does the same thing on that campus. So here's a 3D visualization of stage, again synthesized by independent photographs taken by a large number of students. So it's not just images that we can potentially do this with. Here's the, I don't know how many of you have been to the Google Books Ngram Viewer. You can put in phrases and see how they are used in the entire collection of 15 million books over time. Here I've run Cornell University and Columbia University. You can see we've done pretty well on catching up with Columbia recently. We're on a good trajectory there. And you can imagine that, again, you could do a kind of a visualization and a dive, see how these references facet over subject areas, how they overlap in common. You know, the sort of wealth of massive data, textual and otherwise, lets you do new things that you could have only imagined in 1961. So what is our biggest effort to put Cornell Libraries resources out where people can find them and build on them? We're actually actively collaborating in unbundling library services. It is, of course, Google Books. We're making somewhere between 500,000 and 1.3 million volumes available through Google Books. We've also made 80,000 volumes available for download from the Internet Archive, all public domain materials. And if you didn't know, you can get the print-on-demand volumes from Amazon. So how else are we leveraging technology in new ways? We run one of the largest and most active open access repositories in the world, archive.org. We're also leveraging librarians' own unique knowledge. This is a service from the law library that where law librarians select individual websites that are of particular value to legal scholars and lawyers. And this is a highly used, as I understand it, and valuable source of place to search for legal information over all these selected websites. We're taking other steps to try and go where our students are. Working with a computer science software engineering course, the students there built a iPhone app for the library, working again with the library outside the library group. It's available in the iTunes App Store and lets you see what you've got checked out, lets you search the catalog, look at maps and hours. Let's see, yeah, there I am, and there's what I have checked out. And here's how to find what libraries open at some random hour of the day or night, and potentially contact the librarian as well. For people who don't have iPhones, we are working to make our library websites mobile accessible as well. We're doing other things with smartphones. For example, we're making smart exhibits. Here's an example from the print exhibit on Plums of New York at the at Mann Library, and if you happen to have your iPhone or other smartphone around, you can fire up here. Let's see, Quick Mark. Should be able to get that. Come on. It found it. Okay, so there we go. So QR codes tie the physical world to the virtual one. We're working with RMC potentially to add QR codes to other exhibits and again give the context and expanded information from just the local exhibit. In the case of the Plums in New York, I can actually just immediately access the digital version of the book in the iPhone browser. So I get directly to that digital context. We do other things to connect the physical to the virtual. In this case, it's a nice little card that archive.org has been handing out that will connect you to the new articles in mathematics in archives. I've been talking a lot about cool technology for the library. However, this is really just a tool to connect scholars with information. We're an information organization, not an IT organization. And at this point in the world of 2011, we can't do everything ourselves. We need to search out opportunities to collaborate, to work with others. BarraDirect is a big example of that. It lets Cornell users check out now from up to 70 million books from all the Ivy libraries. They just added Harvard very recently.
Well, they signed on,
sorry. How soon?
Sometime in the spring.
The spring? Okay. I'm sure you've all heard about our Too Cool collaboration, looking at opportunities for deep integration and creation of potentially shared collections. We're working with other collaborations. The Data Conservancy is a large NSF-funded grant focusing on research data curation. The idea is to combine data sets, to be a repository that will combine data sets from different research areas and let you answer new fundamental problems. We have two sub-projects. The DataStar is working to do direct deposit into the Data Conservancy, and Archive is connecting the publications to data sets where the data sets, again, are deposited into the Data Conservancy. Those two pilots are going on right now. We also just recently set up a research data management service group. It's a collaboration of the Cornell Library, Center for Advanced Computing, Cornell Institute for Social and Economic Research. Gail has played a major role in that. It's an example of the new services that we are building as the research and scholarly agenda evolves. Another example you may be familiar with, we're bringing the library's strengths to create new, in this case, national services. VIVO started out here with the work of John Corson Reichert at Cornell, and we recently got in, not quite so recently now, a little over a year ago, got an NIH grant to roll this out as a national service and to scale to a global network of researchers. So VIVO allows you to repurpose and make available a lot of information about Cornell in different ways. In this case, you can search for Life Sciences Research, the research portal. You can potentially divide things up by where they're happening. So if you want to find out who at Cornell is working in a particular country, you can go to the map view and find out who to collaborate with. It was originally built, in fact, to address the needs of graduate students and faculty and new faculty looking at Cornell, potentially interested in coming here, because in the life sciences, faculty and research areas were scattered across all sorts of different colleges, departments, programs. It was really impossible to find out who you might be able to work with without a tool like this. It's not all a bed of roses in the new digital world. We have new opportunities for access, but new challenges as well. Digital preservation is one that our alums may not have been quite so familiar with, but I expect many people in this room are aware of and concerned about. It used to be easy for us. We'd subscribe to magazines and newspapers in print, microfilm, or a subscription database. As you may know, print newspapers are having a tough time these days. And information, both news and culture, is happening elsewhere on the net in non-print forms. This is my daughter's favorite site for culture and celebrity gossip. The challenge for us, how do research libraries preserve news, journalism, and culture when it's fragmented and scattered in a million pieces across the web? We can no longer just subscribe to a nice simple set of newspapers or even electronic databases to cover the materials we want to preserve for future scholars. We are looking right now at doing web curation. We've begun, actually, the discipline-based, working with Columbia, the discipline-based selection archiving of web materials. We've done some initial pilots of archiving Cornell materials that were at risk as well. We've somewhat leveraged the work with Columbia on this. They had a human rights website project, and we're working with them on that, and in fact, as part of Too Cool, we're now combining to use the Internet Archive's archived service to get copies of our at-risk sites, as well as to continue to do, in a more programmatic way, this kind of selection and archiving of important scholarly materials. So we do still rely heavily on the Internet Archive for snapshots of the entire historical web. The Internet Archive, as some of you may know, is a sort of a personal project of Brewster Kahle. You have to wonder how well it will survive past Brewster. Google is also another place we rely on a lot of information, but Google may not always be the same company with the same values. Do we really want to rely on them? Amazon, as some of you may well have heard, deleted copies of Orwell's 1984 and Animal Farm off owners' Kindles. Once they'd already purchased them. It did refund their money, and it has promised not to do it again. However, you can imagine that they, rather than simply delete the copies, they could have simply swapped Eurasia and East Asia and updated history a little bit for them. Digital bits are very fragile, and it's a challenge for us in terms of preservation. You've seen it in terms of websites; they constantly evolve. Same information, New York Times articles typically can get updated over time. It's not the same as it used to be when it was in print. Even if disruption is coming to research libraries, I would ask which of these organizations you would still be around 100 years from now. So what are the strengths of the library and librarians? We have decades of training and experience in selection and curation. Actually, many more than decades. What was your total?
763 years.
Years of combined expertise here. It's pretty impressive.
Probably even more than that, because these were just people who were at their 5 and 10.
So we have a fundamental understanding of how to describe and organize information. We have the ability to recognize the unique needs of researchers, scholars, and students, and create new tools, services, and solutions. We're already doing that. And we have a long and trusted organizational history. So we need to provide certain things in the world of 2011 and beyond. We need disciplinary understanding and expertise. We need a full awareness and engagement with modern IT tools and services. And our raison d'etre, ensuring access to and long-term preservation of the cultural and scholarly record. And close collaboration with IT experts. So I'll wind up with another piece of baseball advice, in this case from Casey Stengel, and then I'll not take the advice and make some predictions for the library in 2021. So the growth in library resources and services will have been mostly digital, and the physical materials will be primarily accessed as digital surrogates. I believe librarians will be the bridge between disciplines and unique information tools and services that they need. I believe the library will be more specialized, providing some global services locally, things like archives, and drawing on consortial partners and outside services for others. I believe we still will hold and create new physical and digital special collections. We'll still be a place where students gather to study, collaborate, and learn. So even in the world of Google, Flickr, Wikipedia, and cloud computing, the library still has a critical role at the center of scholarly life. And fortunately, our president also recognizes that. What a tremendous resource the Cornell Library is for our campus, the community, and the world at large. So thank you. We have time for questions.
Library forum, folks, do we have time for questions?
How are we doing on time?
Yes.
3 o'clock.
It's 3 o'clock. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead.
Question away. There are. Oh, Ed.
Ed, you mentioned that yours is reopening. Is yours, is the library closed after all the opening?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then the Uris brothers helped support its renovation. Eric?
Yeah, and when you and both looked out for the presentation at DC, the number of desktops on the average,
Oh, no, we didn't speak of them. They were, there were 800 of them.
We spoke in front of about 50 people.
Oh. But there were a lot from that same group.
I'm just curious, what were some of the things that you were trying to tell you within the community?
Well, I found out about the nude swimming test.
Well, there was definite interest in the digital preservation. I mean, that wasn't something that they necessarily thought about. There were a couple of people who were emphasizing that the digital stuff is extremely fragile and at risk of change, right? I mean, people can scribble on top of it, and we have to be very careful that we're thinking about it, coming up with ways to prevent people rewriting history in the ways that they might like to have it been.
Gentleman went on and on about when are we going to really go paperless? You know, we're killing all these trees and printing that goes on in the library. So I let Dean take that.
So what's the answer to you? When will we go paperless?
When will we go paperless? Never. I mean, you know, it depends what you mean by paperless. I mean, I do have to say when our new CIO showed up and met with the library executive group, he commented that he had received more paper in his first 2 weeks at Cornell than in his entire 10 years at UBC. So he believes that we can become at least a little less papery.
You know, I met with him earlier this week, though, and he said, I said, well, how's the paper going? And he said, well, I'm getting less and less of it. I said, that's not because they've gone paperless. They've just taken you off the distribution. Any more questions, comments? Ada, anything about the opening?
Well,
of course, once the library was in the library, so I wasn't here on the MCF. There was a time because
he was left for it. My senior year, I was taking Russian history course in the reserve reading. And what is now like Cafe was used for the reserve reading. I bet that pleased the faculty. Well, Chuck was a better class of 100 people in 2 copies.
You could be doing something else while someone was getting your book. Now, once you're a graduate student, the serendipity of what was next to those books was, of course, what you wanted. I was not here in 60.
Well, I understand that most of the people who were actually in the stacks were undergraduates who'd gotten stack passes.
If you couldn't figure out how to get a stack permit, you weren't thinking.
Didn't they forge stack permits?
They didn't even have to do that. Any faculty member was right before.
Oh. Okay. I remember that once.
They still feel it.
Well, there were all the graduate seminar rooms, and people would actually come and study, and it was a way of connecting with those students in your field.
And actually,
many libraries
have closed down. We have to be in
the When did NASDAQ open? Do you anybody know? By the way, the fifth floor of Mann Library burns because a faculty member was smoking a cigarette and it sort of went off onto her note.
Speaking of cigarettes, I remember back in the 80s, well, at first the last smoking could occur anywhere in the library, but then they made, said, okay, we're just going to have the smoking in the faculty room, which means that the smoke got concentrated.
Yeah.
And we would have to shell books in the White Library, and to get there, physically access to the White Library, we parked their book trucks there. And at that time, there was much, much, much heavier book circulation. So right now we might get 5-10 minutes a day worth of Shelby and White Library, perhaps, I guess. But especially towards the end of the semester when books are coming back, we might get 4 or 5 book trucks loaded, double-sided, that you had to park in going in and out. So it was kind of like, it was really nasty. It was only condensed smoking in there.
I remember the cafe had smoking.
The staff lounge.
Sorry, not the cafe, the staff lounge.
Yeah. And then they had that big, they tried to put in this big kind of exhaust fan, but it never worked at all.
Right. Any other comments or observations?
Leah, did you have a... Okay.
Yeah, Margaret?
Thank you. people here are familiar with a lot of things I was talking about, so I wasn't really mentioning.